Hello and welcome to Dirty Laundry Unpacking the Costume Closet. I'm Johanna Pan, and today we'll be discussing feminized labor and pay equity in theatrical costume design and production. I became aware of this topic when I realized that my friends and colleagues in non-costume design and production fields were getting paid far more than I was for comparable work. I wanted to figure out why, and I've discovered that the concept of feminized labor has a lot to do with it. In this episode, I'll sit down and talk with Portia McGovern, Elsa Hiltner, and Jessa Rae Court to find out more. We'll start with Portia McGovern, a lighting designer and the author of the annual study Who Designs and Directs in Lort Theaters by Pronoun. I first met Portia when we worked on Am I, Am I, Am I by Ming Pfeiffer at the Flea Theater in New York.
Hi, Portia.
Hi.
Hi, it's good to see you.
It's nice to see you, too.
Tell us more about Who Designs and Directs for Lort Theaters.
People. People design. I know that seems really simplistic, but really, sometimes I think the larger theater field forgets that. Right? That, like, oh, they magically come in and do things, but we don't actually have to pay attention to them as human beings. Right? Because we're paying them for their product. And you're like, oh, okay, but it's a collaborative art form, right? So at the heart of it, if you take care of people, they'll be able to do their best work, right? Which is the hope in all these situations. Of course, what would I know? I haven't been in the theater since January. maybe it's not like that anymore. Right? So who designs? So costumes, right? It's funny to me that when I do this study, people are frequently like, well, there are more numbers of he designers at the highest levels because there are more number of them at the lower levels, right? And you've got to pay your dues and work your way up and all those things we say. But then you look at costumes, and costumes is not like that, right? From the 12-13 to the 17-18 season, right? In D theaters, you have over 75%. She designers in costumes, but then you get to the A+ level, which granted is much smaller, right? You know, it's something like 10 to 12 shows a season at the A+ level versus several hundred, right? Somewhere in the 2 to 3, somewhere in that middle. At the D level, you get 61, almost 62% at the A+ level. So why do the numbers of she designers go down as you go up if they're more in the right, more at the D level? Right? So that argument doesn't hold up. People frequently make that argument, and then I point to costumes and go, it's not just having more she designers at the lower levels is going to impact the higher levels. Right? And people are like, well, give it time. And I'm like, oh, okay, I've been doing this study for a while now. Right? It's not forever, right? But that's the same argument people make about pipeline, right? Where it's like, oh, well, if we get more she designers and more designers of color in grad school, obviously it will change the pools later. And I'm like, so essentially you're foregoing any agency to make decisions now because you're going to wait for a mythical future where suddenly you'll achieve gender parity or, you know, whatever their version of gender parity is in a decade or two.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's the argument that, like, well, there aren't enough designers of color who are qualified now. And I'm like, well, that's not true. Right? There were plenty of designers of color qualified now and 10 years ago, and there will be more in 10 years. Right? But people don't magically become qualified. Right? Which I frequently think people forget. People forget in theater, right, that it's not just you got into BFA, you got an MFA, you have an MFA from one of the elite schools. And now look, you obviously will be designing in the regional theater system. That works that way for some people, but not most. Okay, I don't know if not most, because I haven't studied the elite grad schools, to tell you the truth, but
that would be an interesting subject to study, wouldn't it? To see, like, how many people from each school are still working.
Mm-hmm.
And what the mix is from each school.
Yeah, or even to just know, you know, okay, in this particular class, what were your percentages? How do people mm-hmm. self-identify? But again, it's got to be self-identified data, right? Because otherwise it leads to like whoever's filling out the survey guessing. And we all know that.
Well, tell me more about that. Yeah, tell me more about that.
So with right, you want to know how people identify themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Because unless they're filling out the form, right, you will have people who guess based on generally appearance, right, or name, right? Long ago, when I went to college, I showed up to my first day of orientation, and, you know, I said my name, and they went, oh, we thought you were going to be a redhead with freckles. And I went, no, I'm not, but where's my dorm room? Right. At 18. You know, so, and people over the years of the study, right, have very much wanted race ethnicity data. And I've always mm-hmm. been like, it has to be self-identified. I can't. And they're like, well, but couldn't you just sort of? And I'm like, no, there's no just sort of. There's no way for me to personally know over, back then, 2,000 designers. Right? Now it's like 2,500 or something. There's no way for me to know that with any real accuracy. It's like, yes, I think I know the vast majority of at least lighting designers of color, right? Either by reputation or personally. But it's not ethical, right? Like, it's not ethical for me to even pretend to guess or try. And that's why I'm hoping, so I put out this survey this last summer, and I'm hoping lots and lots of people will fill it out. But even then, right, with demographic data, you can't extrapolate from, like, this 30% filled it out to, like, oh, this is what the 100% must look like. You can do that with mm-hmm. things on opinion, but you can't really do it for demographics. Right, particularly.
Yeah, how many people have you gotten so far?
300 and like 40 something or other.
Out of 2,500.
Yeah. Well, no, it's more like 300 out of the 2,500 designers and like 42 directors of the something like 800 directors. I'm hoping for more. I'm hoping when the study comes out showing this next year's data that many people will read the new article and be inspired to take the new survey.
Mm-hmm.
I hope.
Yeah, it is. Can you tell me a little bit more about why you started doing the survey?
Why? Because no one would hire me. That's the short answer. Do you want the long answer?
Yeah, I told you, give us a long answer.
All right, long answer. I had a kid. Right? She turned one, and it seemed like everybody in the industry figured out I had a kid, right? Like, it took them a year to be like, oh, that's a child. But I was not, you know, like, I know secret babies happen in theater, but I was not secretive about it. I was just like, here's my kid. And there she is. And suddenly I went from fairly reliably, like, 8 to 12 projects a year, right? To no inquiries, no offers, nothing. And my child napped very well. She napped for 3 hours a day, but you could not make any noise. I mean, like, I could not fold laundry. It was too loud. But I figured out if I was three rooms over, I could very softly type, right? Like, very gently type. You know, I had this 3 hour gap where I suppose I could have napped, right? Thinking in retrospect, like I could have caught up on my sleep during that time, but it never occurred to me. And I thought, well, I've been wondering about this question since I was a year or two out of undergrad, right? So, you know, I had been wondering about that question for about a decade and thought, well, I'll just, you know, all the theaters will obviously have all their designers listed. I'll just go try to figure it out and see what happens. And the thought was, to tell you the truth, that like, oh, maybe I would do a little thing of pie charts, like on my own Facebook page. Maybe even send it to a few friends. That's about it, really. And then I got the numbers through a long process. You know, it took me a solid 7-8 months that first year to get like, to get to 70% of theaters confirming their data. You know, and stats folks have asked me later, why did you pick 70%? Where did that come from? And I'm like, because when I was a kid, that was passing, right? Like you passed the grade if you got 70%. And they were like, you know, you could have gotten 30. And I'm like, oh, nope, I did not know that. I would not have worked so long if I had known that. No, that's not true. I probably still don't work. But, you know, then I got the numbers and they were much worse than even I thought they were going to be, right? Because I'm a woman lighting designer. So I thought, well, you know, I've been mentored by several women who are also lighting designers, and it's got to be in its high, or at least mid 20%, right? Somewhere in there. And then it came back and it was like 13.9, I think, that first year. And I was like, over the 09 to 13, 14 seasons. And I was like, oh, this is bad, right? Like, this is much worse than I had imagined. But with great power comes great responsibility. So then I pitched it to HowlRound because I wanted everyone to have it, right? And I wanted everyone to have it for free. And I like the commons model that HowlRound uses and still uses today. And they said yes, which I've always been a little surprised by, to tell you the truth, because I had no writing experience. I don't have a stats background. I'm not a professor, right? And, you know, I was actually quite surprised that they were like, yes, show us what you got. And I was like, oh, okay, here are my pie charts. And then it went out in the world. And even then I thought, oh, this is going to be a 1 year thing, right? Because by then I started getting offers and inquiries again. And I was like, oh, great, I'll go back to being a line designer, right? And, I got so much feedback that first year, mostly positive, not all positive, but mostly positive. And the ones that struck me the hardest were my fellow women designers who were like, I had no idea it was this bad, right? Because when I'm on a show, there's always a woman on the show, right? And I talking to my peers in my same discipline, they always said, well, but look at you, like you're working. And it's so nice to know I'm not crazy. And I was like, oh, I'm so sorry that the industry for so long has made you feel like you must just not know enough, right? To take your own feelings seriously. And I was like, well, I could do it for one more year, right? Like, it was a lot of time, it was a lot of work, but I don't have that many more shows coming, so I'll keep doing it. The work has snowballed. You know, I started with one chart. Back in 2015 was the first article to come out, and now I think this year's got 49 charts, because I just kept learning more ways to look at the data and present the data. And actually, you know, the data from 12-13 to 18-19 has a whole new way to look at what I've been calling prolificity, right? How prolific designers are, because I get so many questions about those charts that I was like, okay, I'm going to try a whole new way to do this and hope it makes more sense to folks, right?
Yeah, because I think that some of the things that I think really fascinated me about the research that you're doing, I think part of it was that, like, I always find that I am often the only woman or person of color on a team. And I think that's actually really, I think that was actually really interesting to see that, right? Like, it's common for costume designers specifically, and also coming back to this notion of feminized labor, that, like, costume designers are often the only women on the team. And what does that mean for the rest of the team, who's been usually very male, and in my experience, usually very white, but that's not something that we have in the data just yet.
not yet, but hopefully soon, right?
Fingers crossed.
I am hopeful, and I'm also hopeful that, like, if I don't get enough entries by when I would need to, like, okay, this is when you need to start doing the analysis of numbers in 2021, maybe I'll get them by 2022.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, I've sort of committed in my head, at least, to doing this survey for 10 years, right? That this year will be year 6. And so if it takes a little longer, I'll still be here.
Okay, Portia, is there anything else you would like to plug for us today?
I mean, your audience can find my work on HowlRound, right? It's probably easiest to just search my name, right? Which is Portia spelled like the car. P-O-R-S-C-H-E. And then you'll see all the years of articles. Yeah, so I have a Patreon, which lets me keep doing the study and buy things like printer ink so I can print the charts, which is super exciting for me. Because when you print the charts, you can get the sense of trends because you can lay them all out. Versus on, you know, on the screen, it's like, I can't see. They're too small. But the Patreon lets me do cool things like that, which I appreciate, and pay for software, all the things I use to keep the survey and study going. So if folks want to find me there, I'd appreciate it. Take the survey. I'd appreciate that more than anything. It'll be in the show notes because it's long and there's lots of numbers involved.
Thank you so much for talking to us today, Portia.
Of course. You know I love you.
We're so grateful Portia could join us to discuss the invaluable data that she's collected. Now that we've heard a bit about the numbers, let's talk to Elsa Hiltner, a Chicago-based costume designer and wardrobe stylist, about her experiences with labor organizing and on our team.
Hi, everyone. We're here today with Elsa Hiltner, who's a Chicago-based costume designer, wardrobe stylist, and labor organizer. And I first saw her work in an essay called A Call for Equal Support in Theatrical Design, and I've been following her work ever since. And I'm so excited to be able to have her here today to talk about feminized labor. Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I am really excited about this podcast and can't wait to listen to all the episodes. And I'm so honored to be on it with you, too.
And so we're so happy to have you. Okay, Elsa, so if you could just say a little bit more about who you are and how you got started in all of this work.
So I'm a costume designer based in Chicago and a freelance costume designer mostly. And I do wardrobe styling occasionally for commercial stuff, but mostly theater. And I probably about 5 or 6 years ago got really interested in garment labor issues in the fashion industry and consumer issues like that. And that really ticked off realizing the own system that we work in as costume designers and understanding that the issues that I was so passionate about that garment workers were facing were exactly the same issues that I was facing as a costume designer. And just realized that there wasn't much written about it, that, you know, it's kind of something that costume designers talked about with themselves, but that there was some real room for change if we organized and, you know, talked about it, put it in words, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I feel like I keep trying to look for books or people who have written about this topic, and there's just so little out there that actually even talks about what it is. So if you could just for me, like, define what does feminized labor mean to you?
Yeah, so I mean, it feels like women's work and the way that women's work is defined as things that, you know, like female identified people do, and also that is not like it's not necessary to compensate that in any meaningful way. It's just kind of expected. And you know, in addition, it's you know, not just for women, it's also like anybody who does that kind of work is penalized in that way, that like we penalize people who are women or act like women or do female sort of things. And so you know, it comes with like the unpaid labor of, you know, housework or those sorts of things, childcare, but then also like when you're looking at garment work, like the unpaid labor of, you know, the extra work that costume designers do, how it's compensated. First off, you know, like stitchers not being paid as well as carpenters or scenic painters, that sort of thing. And then, you know, it affects anybody who has that job, regardless of what gender they are.
Right, because I remember, and this is the thing that I think my first awakening to this problem, because we didn't have this problem in colleges, right? Like, or at least like when we were working in the shops in school, everyone was kind of paid the same amount of money. So that wasn't actually an issue. It wasn't something that I ever clarified for myself in my mind. And it wasn't until I graduated, and I think I applied for a job at a costume shop in New York City, and the starting rate for a stitcher for a Broadway costume shop was $11 an hour. And I just remember we had this thing called field studies in undergrad where we all came to New York City. We got to tour different theaters and like meet alumni and talk to them about their work. And I remember having seen a local one pay stub. And that was like a really big thing because when we went to visit a theater, one of the local one guys just like handed us his pay stub and he was like, here, this is how much I'm on Broadway. You should know this number because it's an important number to rate everything up against. And I just remember that $11 an hour being so far away from any of that. And I was just kind of appalled that like, how could anyone make a living in New York City on $11 an hour with rent?
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like my college education really missed out on a lot of the business side and the reality side of like navigating the world as a freelance designer and negotiating and contracts and all of that. And, you know, like colleges also have lots of issues as far as like the paid staff, right? I mean, it's like maybe they pay those students all the same, but faculty and staff is pretty important. But yeah, I mean, that also like speaks to how important transparency is, right? Like if you had not seen that pay stub, would you have known the like gravity of that $11 an hour aside from like the actual like monetary amount and how to like support yourself? But like, you know, would you have like known how inequitable it was?
Yeah, I think the other shoe finally dropped when my partner, moved to New York City, and he was looking for work as a scenic carpenter, and he was getting paid probably like $20-$22 right off the bat, and this was working at off-Broadway scenic shops. And I remember there was a moment where when I heard that number, I was so furious because I felt like I had been struggling to fight for $20 an hour in Broadway costume shops. And he was just walking in, a fresh grad. It was 2 years out. He was walking in a fresh grad and getting $22 right off the bat. And I just remember being so angry. And I tried to express, I realized I didn't have the words. I didn't know how to articulate how unfair and unjust that moment was. And I was trying to explain to him this anger, and he just didn't get it. It was a long night and a long conversation, and he gets it now, but, you know, it's hard to see.
Yeah, and that's such a universal experience, I feel, for people that work in the costume and garment fields, you know? Like, I feel like we've all had that moment. And also, like, one of the issues I have with, like the term pay equity is that so often it's defined as like within the same job title. And so there's like, you know, all stitchers are paid this amount and all carpenters are paid this amount and all costume designers this amount. And that's pay equity. But it's not actually equitable when you like put those things in relationship to each other. And that's really important when you're talking about like the holistic like space that a company takes and the way the workers work within a company and collaborate within a company. And, you know, that's, you know, been a little bit of an uphill battle, talking with companies about pay equity. Is they're like, oh, well, everybody's paid the same within this area or this area, but they don't look at the relationship between those.
Yeah. It's hard to explain that, I guess. For me, a scenic carpenter doesn't necessarily even need a master's degree, but so many drapers do, right? And so many drapers and craftspeople in costumes in particular have master's degrees in how to make things, because the things that we do, it's engineering too. We engineer basically sculptures on humans that dance and move and do crazy feats of magic 8 times a week.
Right, right. It's building the directions. It's not just following them, mm-hmm. Which is a big difference. And yeah, I mean, it's just amazing that people don't see stitching work or garment making as like the skilled labor it is, because it's incredibly skilled. I mean, like to set a sleeve or a zipper, you know, those are pretty basic.
Oh, so also, hard.
Like, how many people can do that? Right. I mean, that's like, you know, that's not even drafting.
There's an Instagram account called Can You Sew This For Me? Have you ever seen it?
No.
Oh, it's amazing though. It's amazing. It's basically like a list of conversations that people have who are like, I saw this dress online and it costs $200. Can you make it for me for $10? And it's just like, that doesn't even begin to cover the cost of the fabric, guys. Come on.
Yeah, that's crushing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess so. Maybe we can also talk a little bit about how the idea of feminized labor began, especially for garment workers, right? Because to me, it's that kind of starts in the Industrial Revolution. What do you think?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's how I've always seen it too. That, like, you know, prior to the Industrial Revolution, like men had most of the paid tailor jobs. The Industrial Revolution happened. There were these big garment shops. They needed cheap labor that was expendable, and they brought in women to do that. And that kind of set up, you know, I feel like everything, you know, the Industrial Revolution changed a lot of things, obviously, but really set up the way that women's labor is not valued. And also interesting at the same time, you have this like Victorian, like beginning of toxic masculinity. And, you know, like all of this stuff feels very intertwined. And the way that, you know, feminized labor is also like penalizing men who associate with women's work and, you know, very toxic masculinity in that way. And so, you know, it's 100 years, 150 years, however you want to define when the Industrial Revolution was, but like later, and we're still working in this mode of, you know, having mostly women and mostly underpaid women create garments in whatever field you're in.
And it's also fascinating because women, it's not like the Industrial Revolution happened and women started making clothes starting at the Industrial Revolution. Women have been making clothes since the beginning of time, but it's men that were paid for this work earlier, before the Industrial Revolution. And it wasn't actually until the Industrial Revolution that women really started getting actually paid to be dressmakers.
Yeah, yeah. I think there was like a pretty good like cottage industry sort of thing, at least in Western history, you know, of like women, you know, would like work out of their home and, you know, that kind of thing. But and in like a professional capacity that like we recognize as, you know, contributing to society and all of that.
I would love to talk a little bit about why feminized labor is problematic, and specifically how the way we view feminized labor and how it's problematic for us and how we think about our clothing and the way that we dress.
Part of it is we can buy clothes for so cheap, right? You can get a blazer for like $15 at Old Navy. And because you can get a blazer for $15, when you ask a costume designer to build or draft a blazer, it seems like a very simple, easy thing. It's got to be quick. You know, what's $15? Like maybe that's an hour of work, maybe. And that's kind of like how people think about it. And so that affects, you know, how we value people's time. And then also like this idea that, you know, there's all of this unpaid labor that goes into this, because obviously you can't build or, you know, pattern a blazer in an hour. All this unpaid labor that goes into it. And, you know, whether or not it's being explicitly asked for, it's being asked for. And, you know, the way that women can't or don't feel like they can ask for more hours paid or higher pay. And, you know, obviously it's not just women. It's, you know, pretty much any group that's been marginalized in whatever way they've been marginalized. I just want to be like, when I say women, it's not just it's not just women in the, you know, in that sense.
Yeah. I remember there was a story that I heard from a different designer who, because it affects our budgets, right? Like, it goes all the way up, and producers, the way they set right. our budgets, they kind of assume that we're going to be shopping at Old Navy, at H&M, at Forever 21, and that's the price of how much they budget for an outfit of clothing. So for example, like, so many budgets I get, right. I get given maybe like $50 to $100 for a contemporary show per person. And that's like all of their looks too. So you're assuming that there's a stock to pull from. And you're also assuming that all of this clothing is coming from these places where clothing is cheap, and the cheapness of the clothing comes in the labor and the conditions under which that clothing is made. The cost of the clothing comes out of the environment in terms of synthetic materials and like cheap fabrics that we use and we make to make that clothing. So this idea of feminized labor, just, it kind of trickles down and affects so many more people than just us as costume designers or costume technicians. Story.
Yeah, definitely.
I remember it was so fascinating because this designer basically walked into a room full of producers who had told her that her budget was smaller than what she wanted it to be. And she went around the room asking each producer to tell her how much money their suit cost, and how much money their shirt cost, how much money their haircut was, and their glasses, and their cufflinks, and their socks, and their shoes. And she asked them each to add it all up and then tell her how much money that outfit that they were wearing into the room cost.
Right.
And basically broke it down, and she made her case, and she got more money in her budget because she was able to show them that a good outfit that looked expensive or like represented something that was not just cheap contemporary clothing wasn't cheap.
Yeah, that's a great way to do it. And I mean the disconnect, right, that happens is just astounding, that you actually have to ask people to add up what they wear to, you know, like make that connection for them. Yeah, that's amazing.
Right.
I think the other thing is, like, you know, as somebody who's concerned about labor issues and women in garment work and all of that, like, I don't want to buy clothes from Old Navy.
I don't.
Like, I don't want to support the garment industry. And it, obviously, it's not just Old Navy. It's like pretty much anywhere you buy clothing. But like, I don't want to do that. And so I end up thrifting a lot. It's better for the environment, obviously. And then I know that I'm not supporting, you know, like this garment industry that's just so toxic to the people and the environment that it's in. And, you know, that also takes more time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not necessarily cheaper, but it's definitely better. And so, you know, also that tends to be, it's like, you know, as a costume designer, like, I will take on that unpaid labor of like putting in that extra time to do that in the way that I feel is the right and better way to do it. But then again, you're in that same situation of, you know, somebody is doing the unpaid labor. Well, it's so hidden, you know, like as a consumer, unless you are like seeking out information about the garment industry, it's really hidden. And like, you know, you don't know about those sorts of things unless you follow news sources that cover that. And it's really not like your standard news source. And I feel like it's the same thing in theater, where like as a audience member or as a donor or a foundation, like, do they know what labor issues are happening within the theater industry, or like the pay inequities, or just the low rates of pay that, you know, you think about, like, you know, big theaters in Chicago, for instance, that pay, you know, $500 for an assistant. And these are like the big theaters. And like, I would be amazed if people seeing those shows thought that, you know, I think there's this image that like theater artists are making lots of money, we're really successful, the theaters are big fancy buildings, there's kind of like a glamour to being an artist. And you know, I think that there's this image that you know, designers who are working at Steppenwolf or the Goodman or, you know, whatever theater you want to pick, are you know, making a good amount of money and being successful. And it's just not really true in that way.
I know. I remember hearing that, I think, Williamstown Theater Festival, which is very well known, pays their designers like $1,000 for a show.
Yeah. It's nuts. I mean, it's just, you know, did you know about like the normal pay rates like this when you were in college?
Or no,
was it ever talked about?
We never talked about it. And I think that's the other part is that like, it's not something that is actually discussed because we never talked about the politics of it. We never talked about gender inequities. We never talked about race inequities. Like that just never was something that came up or I think in something that people were cognizant of having the conversation about. I think that's changing because that was also a while ago and people are, I think, are more aware now than they used to be. But yeah, no, it wasn't something we ever talked about. No one ever told us not to take an unpaid internship. In fact, they sent all of us to Williamstown. I didn't do it, but a lot of my friends did. Yeah.
I mean, I was told, to like always, if you were offered a job, always take it because you never know who's going to be working there that'll like lead you to the next thing, which is just like terrible advice.
So that's actually like part of the problem, right? Because we work in an industry that all of our work or like a lot of our work is based on word of mouth, right? And so then it feels like you can't stand up for yourself because you risk burning bridges, but when having like ground to stand on or like morals or like an ethos to stand by. And it feels like hard to sometimes fight for yourself because if you fight for yourself, you suddenly become, especially when you're a woman or a person of color, like you become the angry person in the room who's then fighting for things and being petty and asking about money. But I feel like as costume designers, we also handle our own budget. So we're always dealing with money. We're always talking to producers about money. Yeah. And we're always the women haggling over money.
Yes, that's so true. And also like, you know, this is a collaborative field and we're also often working with people who we like or friends of ours. And I felt like on, you know, some negotiations that have been very contentious over, you know, there was a show that I did that all the other designers were offered 2,000 and I was offered 1,500 and all the other designers had labor support and I did not. And, you know, I felt like I had to pick one, either ask for money or ask for labor support. So I asked for the money. And it was an incredibly contentious negotiation, over $500. And it lasted weeks and they threatened me with legal action. And it was just, it was awful. And it was on a show that I deeply cared about. I was friends with many of the other designers on the team. And, you know, there was a point where I was like, I might walk away from this show, you know, 2 weeks before it opens, having done nothing with the costumes and, you know, really screwing them over in a way that I did not want to do, but because I was not going to do the design for less than the other designers were offered. And, you know, it's like a very difficult spot to be in. But then also when we're working with people we care about, working with people we want to work with again, it's really difficult. And also no one should be put in that situation, right? Like this should be so apparent and clear to everybody that, you know, pay equity is important and, numbers matter and how we value work matters. But just the way that it's, you know, and it's done to the people who are easy, like it's done to people who they can get away with the easiest, right? So it's like, who's marginalized, who can't negotiate for themselves. Like that's who gets less money. And, you know, we don't often see it because we don't see contracts before we sign ours. And I was lucky on that one that I knew the other designers and had asked them before I signed mine. But, you know, it shouldn't be up to luck. It shouldn't be, you know, labor that you have to do on your own to find out. It should be all out there in the open.
And all of that, did you ever talk to the other designers to help stand with you in negotiations with this company?
Yeah. This was a the second production of this show, and the first production of the show, I had just, it wasn't like a bad negotiation. It just took me a while to get them to add a sentence to the contract that I needed. And so it was just like an ongoing thing. So I was like, this time around, would everybody wait to sign contracts until we all have the language we need? And they were like, yeah, sounds great. So when the contracts came through, people were really transparent and forward with like, here's what's in my contract. And that's when I realized, is because other people said like, oh, I'm getting 2,000 or whatever. That's when I realized that mine was less. And everybody agreed to not sign the contract until I had mine. And I didn't get to the point where I had to tell the producer that no one else had signed their contract for that reason, that if I didn't sign mine, that like, you know, it was a bigger problem than just me. But, you know, that was really helpful to have in my back pocket, and also to know that the other designers understood and supported what was happening and were there, you know, if I needed to pull that card out. And I know other designers have done that too. I don't know if you've ever been in that situation, but I've heard of that similar sort of like mini union.
Yeah, I think for me, more often what has happened is pay transparency. So like really just talking very openly about what's in our contract, if we are getting assistant help, or like what the labor, assistant labor is like, or what the, even like things down to like per diem and like our reimbursements, or how much we're getting paid. And you don't have to know the person, the other designers on the team, to even say something, right? You can just send them an email. If you know who the other people are, you can just reach out to them and ask them how much they're getting paid, what their contract looks like. And people are so often so willing to share. We're just afraid of reaching out and sometimes talking to people that we don't know about money first, right?
Sure. I feel like, though, that often I don't know who's on the team until I've signed the contract. And that really affects my ability to find out what they're being paid and then to know if my contract is fair. I did this thing this summer where I emailed every theater in Chicago that's part of the League of Chicago Theaters to see if they'd talk to me about pay equity. And about a third of them responded. So I did, I think, just under 50 interviews with the leadership from theater companies of all sizes. And one thing that I learned from those interviews is that they also like don't really know how to like gauge labor and what the numbers should be. And they're just kind of going off what they think the norms are and like not necessarily having much confidence in how they decide the pay numbers. And that was like hugely eye-opening, right? But also that's like a really easy thing to fix. You know, it's kind of like the best scenario because, you know, they want to know what's right and they want to do it right. They just don't know. And what we're going off is like the norms of the industry and like norms in quotes, you know? And all we have to do is say like, these norms are not normal. They're not equitable. They're not fair. They're biased in all sorts of ways. Here's what we need to be doing. And then we can actually, you know, people, I really think, you know, the doing the interviews really changed my views of like how theater companies operate and like their role in this system and how complicit they are. And I really think that most people that are running theater companies want to do it right and just don't really know how and are just doing it the way it's always been done and not thinking about it, not thinking about the implications or how it affects individual people.
That's really unfortunate. And I hope that maybe listening to this conversation will help them think about that a little harder. Also, can you tell me a little bit more? Was this work with on our team? Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I wrote an equal call for support in theatrical design, very much on my own, having only had like little conversations with other designers, but not having a big network of designers that were in my circle. Unless I had assisted somebody or had somebody assist me, I didn't really know many costume designers, and I'm also not in the union, so there's, you know, that extra kind of like isolation within the industry. And so I wrote that not knowing that the union was forming a costume committee in Chicago about these same issues. And so once that essay came out, I was connected with the costume designers who were organizing that. And you know, it's Jenny Manis and Christine Pasquale and Janice Patel and a bunch of others. So there was this kind of movement to have collective action around these issues of labor support. That kind of felt like the first step for a lot of us, you know, and then pay equity is, you know, the second part of it. You know, we had monthly meetings and, you know, there was action going on there, which really made some changes in Chicago. And then I was kind of, I don't know. You know, like working individually, you can accomplish some things, but if you have a group in an organization that's not a single person, you can accomplish other things. And so Christine Pasquale and Teresa Hamm and Bob Kuhn were all kind of also doing things individually and speaking out individually. And it felt like forming a group, we could do things that we weren't able to do individually. And so the first thing we did was we had a letter petition for the League of Chicago Theaters to require clear rates of pay on their job board, which I had asked for, you know, just like me emailing them in the past and not gotten a response because, you know, they didn't know me, you know. But then when you have a group, it's not just like, you know, Elsa doing this or, you know, whoever doing this. And so we had like 700 people sign the letter and it was instant. You know, we sent the letter to the league. They made the change, you know, within a week. It was made that action much easier. And so we've been, you know, the pandemic really interrupted it as it's interrupted a lot of things, but we're working on creating pay equity standards so that theater companies can kind of sign on to this list of standards, say, we'll do these things, we'll be transparent with our pay, we'll, you know, have a pay equity audit so we know, you know, where we need to have areas of growth, these sorts of things that companies can sign on to pretty easily that also kind of have a roadmap to like making better decisions and establishing a pay equity policy. And so, you know, having something like that companies can sign on to kind of keep the conversation going and actually encourage companies to have action and give them some steps. Because the other thing that came out of these interviews this summer is that theater companies don't really know what to do and they want to be told what to do and how to do it. And I feel like as a group, we can do that for them.
Great. Yeah. So I was also going to ask you, what are some of the other ways that together we can combat this? So for example, like I know for me, even in my personal practice, especially when I work as an assistant, what I often do is that they tell me what the fee is, and then I break it down into man hours or person hours of like if the fee is $2,000 and my hourly rate is $20 an hour, which I already, for New York City, if you look at what other assistants are making and other technicians are making, is already on the low end, that I'd be like, okay, that's about 100 hours worth of work. 100 hours worth of work is 2.5 weeks. So you have me for 2.5 weeks as a shopper, as an assistant, doing whatever you need to do. And then once I hit those 100 hours, I'm going to tap out. I'm going to say I don't work anymore unless I get paid hourly or there is additional compensation. And for me, that has been very successful, like especially with the designers and the producers that I've worked with, because once I found that once I break it down into hours, people understand the value of the amount of money that they're offering. But that's how I personally done it. So I'd be curious to hear any other strategies that you have in order to help combat all of this.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, I think that more producers should break things down hourly. You know, we have this like weird fee-based system. It's like perfect for inequity, you know? But I think it's important that it's not just costume designers working for labor equity and pay equity that we have. Anybody can do this if they're involved in theater. If you are just a patron of theater, you can, you know, call the company and ask them, do they have a pay equity policy? How do they break down fees? You know, board members should definitely be doing this when they see annual budgets. They should be asking, you know, how does the executive pay relate to, you know, the lowest paid person within the company, or how different artists are paid in relationship to each other. And I think, every company should have clear rates of pay on all job postings. There should never be based on experience. There should never be, you know, my favorite is the there is pay. Like, what does that even mean? You know, like, just this idea that we don't have to pay. I mean, that's like the underlying message behind that, is that like the pay is like a bonus. Like, oh, there's pay. No.
I feel like the one that I've seen online that has been really helpful is the clear wage posting, right? Because now I think on several Facebook groups, like there's a clear wage posting. So you have to put the pay range in order to be able to post the job that you're putting up.
Yeah, yeah. And that's so important, because all you have to do is ask for that. And it's huge for, you know, having people see, like, you know, I was the costume shop manager at a one of the larger theaters in Chicago, and this was in 2007. I was paid $12 an hour, and their entry level, like, marketing positions, like the marketing assistant or something like this, or the development assistant, you know, entry level office was $15 an hour. And I learned that from a job posting, right? And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm down here in the basement running the entire shop, managing wardrobe, like, you know, doing all of the drafting and the stitching and the dyeing and like wig maintenance and like, you know, the whole thing. And you know, those like $12 an hour. But you know, I did not know that until, I saw that job posting, right? 'Cause you don't know these things unless you see them. And, yeah, so I think, artists talking about pay with each other is really important. I think sometimes there's this feeling of like trying to exude success and look like you're, you know, making it and not struggling. And we're all struggling, you know, I mean, there's very few of us who are not. So talking about pay within each other is really important. If you're hiring an assistant and negotiating that fee for, you know, the assistant with the, you know, production company or whatever it is, you know, making sure that that assistant is going to be paid equitably and, you know, at a living wage rate is really important. And then, you know, just having other designers talk about, you know, like, oh, okay, I'm getting, you know, an Emmy. Like, what's the costume designer getting? You know, I would love to see more scenic and lighting designers in particular asking, like, what support does the, you know, the video designer get, or the composer, or the props designer? You know, it's not just costume design that's facing these issues, although, you know, we kind of have them compounded in a few different ways. But there's lots of other designers that are not being equitably paid either.
Elsa, can you tell us more about the work you're doing, and where can we find that information?
So you can go to onourteam.org, and there's lots of links to different actions and resources and things there. I also have a theatrical designer pay resource that you can reference, and it's through my website, which is elsahiltner.com. And you can see it's crowdsourced pay data from across the USA. For designers, you can also submit your own pay data if you are a designer, and I'll upload it in that document. But you can search by, you know, region, state, city, that kind of thing. And then I also have a Patreon where I put, you know, things I'm working on, writing updates on, you know, interviewing companies and getting some pay equity action. So there's that too.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Moving on, let's meet Jessica Court from Costume Professionals for Wage Equity.
Okay, so what is Costume Professionals for Wage Equity?
It's a group of people that came together from the, I think we're almost all from the costume world. I think that there's a couple outliers that are sort of like, you know, involved in theater and sort of interested in the wage equity part, because it does, you know, obviously there's more than just, you know, costume professionals having issues with wage equity in theater and performing arts. But it's a group of people that came together about a year and a half ago, will be 2 years in May, whatever that is, a year and a half. And we came together to sort of start talking about the issues with, I guess it's non-union theater in New York and beyond. At first, we thought we would keep it to sort of North America, but we've started letting, you know, people from around the world in, because it seems to be a global issue, you know, in some parts of the world more than others. But we seem to get a lot of people from the UK. And so we came together, and it's sort of, you know, addressing issues that the union would address for some of us, but because not all of us are in a union, and it doesn't make sense for all of us to be in a union. You know, if you're in a rural area and you have like one or two theaters that you can work with, like, why would you join the union in New York? And to sort of talk about advocating for wage equity and how we can sort of attack the situation with good results, you know, and how to be sort of effective and not, you know, we can all be angry, but we can't bring that anger to the table when we're negotiating. So I think that that's sort of been the backbone of our mission from the beginning, is how to be effective in negotiating, how to sort of show that there's a larger group that all feel the same way. It's not just like one person. Because I think for so long, a lot of us felt like we were sort of speaking for ourselves and sort of alone, you know, and to have some sort of group and some sort of sounding board to come to, you know, on Facebook was really the goal and really where it came from. Genevieve started it and got the other three of us, Elizabeth Weisler, Jeanette Elt, and myself all together. And we sort of helm it, I guess, but we certainly don't want to be the voices for other people. We want to sort of teach people and get people to use their own voices.
So tell me a little bit more about the work that you guys do together in CPE.
We write a lot of letters, and we talk about stuff that happens on Facebook a lot. Like, for instance, I don't know if you've caught what's happening with the Flea Theater right now. If you haven't, check into it. It's very, you know, it's disheartening, but it's also heartening in a lot of ways. It's, you know, the residents of the Flea Theater who were unpaid got, I'm going to use air quotes, let go the other day, because they had a list of things that I guess they were demands, but they just sounded like things that should happen anyway. I don't have it in front of me. I just have a couple notes in front of me, but looking it up and really looking at their statement, they released a statement the other day. I think it was the day before yesterday. You know, talking about what's been happening and their negotiation situation and the lack thereof of negotiation, and the fact that people don't really want to listen, and the fact that, you know, the Flea Theater, if you look into it even in a cursory fashion, you find out that they have tons of money. They have real estate holdings. They have, you know, good investors. They have good fundraisers and you know, people that support them. And there's absolutely a way to pay everybody equitably from their income. But instead, they'd rather not. Who knows why, and who knows, you know, we can all guess, but like, we, you know, we really, you can't assume anything. But, you know, it's really, so we talked about that for a while, and like how, you know, that would sort of how it affects us. I mean, you know, just because we only work in costumes or we work in costumes doesn't mean that what's happening at the food doesn't affect us. You know, they're all writers and directors, and I think it's mostly writers and directors, I think, are the residents at the plea, but and you know, too, because they sort of feel like if the people that are producing the scripts and the actual like raw content that we then sort of, you know, flesh out aren't being treated with respect and dignity and, you know, equitable wages, how are we ever going to expect that? You know, I think it's an uphill battle, but, you know, we have some really good tactics to sort of deal with that inequity and that sort of attitude towards you don't matter and, you know, I can do that. And, you know, because everybody gets dressed in the morning, quote unquote, in the afternoon, maybe if you're working at night, but, you know, everybody gets dressed or everybody thinks that they know what we do. And I think that that's
so. Yeah. So when you guys are writing letters, who are you writing these letters to and what are the letters about?
You know, we started off and we wrote some letters to, I can't remember exactly who it was, but we have a template now based on the first few letters that we wrote out to the artistic director, I believe, and the boards, because those are the people that are really, you know, able to enact change. And so now we have a template, and what we do is we sort of push, we don't really push, equity isn't just about how much money you're making, right? It's not like, here, you own me for a month, and this is how much it's going to take to own me for a month. It's like, okay, well, you only have $250. What does that mean? What does that get you? You know, and sort of tempering expectations. And we've actually made a lot of headway with sending letters and sort of opening people's minds up to how that works. And you know, no, you don't get me full time. And, you know, for X amount of money, you don't get me full time, and I'm not going to answer my phone every time you call, and you don't get 15 fittings, and you don't get to change your mind at the last minute. And, you know, I might not be there for every second of tech. We might have to like really schedule me into tech and like really focus on the costumes when I'm there, because I won't be there the whole time. You know, there's all sorts of bargaining chips. And like, you know, if you're the designer, for instance, maybe you're not building the show. That's a novel concept to some people. You know, there's all sorts of bargaining chips, like bargaining aspects to, you know, a situation, and sort of thinking about what, because we all know what each individual role is supposed to do and what we actually do. So bringing that to the table and say, listen, I'm only supposed to be building the costumes. I'm not supposed to be taking care of them. I'm not supposed to be, you know, fixing them during the run of the show. I'm only building the costumes. This is what this means, you know, or designing the costumes, or I'm the wardrobe person. No, I'm not doing props, like all of that stuff, and making sure that expectations are written out and everybody understands what's happening. And if somebody asks you to do something that that doesn't make sense to your role, making sure that you talk about it. Because I think a lot of times we just say, oh, okay. You know, like I know I did, especially when I was 20 years old, I would do anything, you know.
It was something that I've actually seen recently in a show that I'm working on right now, actually, is a collaborator's agreement. And I wonder if that's something that you guys would be interested in or like have talked about, because it's actually been really useful, and it sets up some basic ground rules. For example, if someone sends a text after 10 p.m. that's work-related, or an email after 10 p.m., that person doesn't have to respond to that until the next morning, because that's an unreasonable ask. This is the scope of my job, and like this is what I should do. And having everyone on the team sign it and agree to it.
Yeah. I think that that's great. And I would love to see the one that you're working with, because it seems like it's working for you. You know, we haven't really discussed that. We've discussed like sort of you know, having everything in writing, but we haven't talked about a collaborator's agreement specifically that I can remember.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. It has some like even like care practices and things about like, and I think something that is comes up very often now is like touching people and how much you can and should or should not touch someone. Yeah, and the really great example, which was no sticking body parts in other people's orifices. For example, like sticking your finger in someone else's mouth or ear, right? As like, but like the general like act of like doing that is something that no one should be doing, and like having that spelled out in such a lovely and clear way was like so refreshing to see. This just happened this past week for me, so like it's very fresh in my mind.
And that's through for the whole company to sign.
Yeah, so everyone, actors, the creative team, everyone reads it together. Like we all went around in a circle, and each person read like a paragraph or like a line of it. And then at the end of it, we talked about whether or not we agreed with the things, or if we wanted to change or add something. And then we all signed it at the end together. I did a workshop here in Singapore that talked about care practices in theater and in performing arts, and how we can care for our collaborators and each other. And actually, so both my director, myself, one of our dramaturgs, and one of our performers were all in this workshop together. And so I think some of that came out of that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, you've been talking a little bit about personal, like, care and keeping up, you know, and I think that so many people think that just paying people is important. And I think that, you know, we were talking a lot last night about what pay equity means and what equity means and what we mean by equity. And it's beyond that. It's like the pay equity is important, but like, you know, talking about, you know, the management of expectations, like the labor equity, like if you're hired as the designer, you're hired as the designer. Like, you're not building costumes. You're not running the show. You're not doing the laundry. You're designing the show. Like, and so many times I feel like, you know, somebody's like, okay, will you come design my show? And I'm like, yeah. And then they get mad when you're like not doing the laundry or not building the show or not doing whatever.
Which is always confusing. It's always confusing because the set designers don't have to build props and the light. I don't see many lighting designers getting on a genie. I mean, yes, they're on stage and yes, they're guiding focus and they're doing things, but they're not actually touching the light. And why is it that costume designers are always touching the costume? Like, why are we always doing all the technicians work as well? Like, how do we end up doing all that double duty? And it's precisely because of the labor equity of the issue.
It's labor equity, but it goes beyond that. And I think it really comes down to the fact that, you know, wardrobe people, the wardrobe department and the costume department comes out of women's work, you know, regardless of your gender or whatever. Nowadays, the fact of the matter is that this work comes from what's generally assumed to be women's work, sewing and laundry and design and, you know, all that stuff. And
it's domestic.
It's all domestic. It's all, you know, floofy sort of, and it's all, you know, we know that it's not, and we know that we bleed on the costumes, and we know that it's like a lot of like, you know, cerebral work, and you have to have like this insane library in your head, regardless of how much research you're doing. But, you know, the greater public doesn't see that and doesn't.
And it's also and it's also the perception of the value of the labor, right? It's this idea that oh, if my mother can do it, you know, it's really easy to do it. Or like, my mother has been doing this, so it should be easy for anyone else to be able to do this. And no one really thinks about how much skill it requires.
Absolutely. And I think that there's also that whole situation of, you know, I can do it too. Like, oh, I go buy my own clothes. Oh, I've made a pillow before. Like, it can't be that hard, you know? And it's, they don't even know that it's insulting. You know, like, people just don't understand. They're like, I hate it. My number one pet peeve when I was working in shops was referring to the shop as a sweatshop. I'm like, no, it's not. No.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I think that, you know, bringing things to the table and communication is key. And I think for so long we've been sort of groomed to not communicate and just take what we're given and take what's offered and not sort of push back and not even try to negotiate. But Elizabeth, I think, will sort of elaborate on this next week, maybe. But we were talking about the pay equity, the labor equity, and health equity. And I think that that sort of ties into what we were talking about. But it's not just like your work environment. I mean, that's important. Like, you need to make sure that you have, you know, everything you need to work appropriately. But at the same time, like, are they calling you after 10 p.m.? You know, and like, that's what I loved about what you brought up. You know, that's important to have like you time. Like, mm-hmm. you can't expect somebody to just be on 24 hours, especially if you're not going to pay them a ton of money. Like, they 100% have another job. You know, who can pay their rent in New York City for $250 for a month? I mean, come on. And you know, you're not on call and you're not at their beck and call. Like, if they call you after 10 p.m. and they're like, you have to come in tomorrow at 7 a.m. and do this thing before our rehearsal, like, no. Like,
I remember, it was a show at Columbia. So, like, first of all, NYU students weren't allowed to get paid for shows at Columbia. Like, specifically, only NYU students weren't allowed to get paid to do shows at Columbia. And I was working on this show, and I cleared my entire day because it was my partner's birthday. And I wanted to make sure that I spent the entire day with him. Like, it was also, like, the end of grad school. I wanted to make sure that, you know, that day was just about him, because so many of the days before that weren't. And I got this blistering email about where are the receipts, and then multiple calls from the producer about how I hadn't turned in the receipts yet. And I told him, I was like, hey, like, I'll get it to you tomorrow. Today is a me day. This is like specific time that I've set aside. I can't do this right now. I'm outside. I don't have access to any of it. I won't be able to get it to you until tomorrow. And he just let loose on me. And I just remember, like, wow, like, this didn't make me happy. I was not, I was trying to have a celebratory day with my partner, whom I had given up a lot of my time for free to do this show, and now is having some time for us, and he just let loose, and I was just like, this is terrible, and it's not okay, and I hung up on him, and then I turned off my phone, and came back to it the next day with, like, these, like, terrible emails. I was just like, this is terrible. Like, why would you do this to someone?
And I think, you know, I can only imagine that that was a few years ago, right? You know,
before. 2 years ago.
Okay, so it was like right before CPWE started.
Yeah.
So, but there was no, so you didn't have us. And our.
No, I didn't. But I didn't. Feel like it's true.
If we had been around and you had been aware of us, you know, that's the kind of person and that's the kind of situation where we're happy to step in or, you know, steer you to our templates and be like, listen, write a letter and we can all, you know, sort of rally behind you and say, this is not how you operate. And this is not what you get for no money, little money, you know. You know, she needs to be able to say, and you need to be able to say, I can't do that right now. And just because he wants you to, doesn't mean that he gets it.
Tell us a little bit about the new pay transparency initiative that you guys have going.
Well, we're working on a postcard initiative, and we're working on a phone bank. So, you know, look for that and The other thing we wanted to sort of touch on with membership is that if you're a member, great. And if you're not a member, don't invite people, have people apply themselves. We don't necessarily accept membership from people that are invited. I had somebody have some issues doing it, and so I invited them and immediately accepted them. But if you're having problems and you have to do it, just text us and be like, hey, I had to invite this person, they were having issues. Because otherwise we end up with a bunch of, you know, bots.
Is there, I think Shana will always remind me to do this, is there anything else you guys would like to share or blast on our podcast today?
I think that the forthcoming postcard and phone banking is really the big thing, and keep your eyes open, and you know, keep on engaging on the Facebook group, and you know, if you're having any issues, it's been a little quiet right now because not a lot of people are working. But if you want to talk about what the conversation seems to be now is like how to move forward and how to build a better future, which I think is a really good place to start. And it's a really good attitude to sort of have, rather than like going at people, be like, hey, this was not working for me before we stopped working. How can we make this better moving forward? You know, and especially keeping in mind that a lot of places are struggling for money, you know, talk about, you know, all the things we talked about before and see where that lands you. You know, because I think opening up a line of communication rather than, you know, yelling at people and telling them that they're wrong is really seems to be the more fruitful option.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much for today, Jessa.
Absolutely. Anytime.
That's about it for this week's Dirty Laundry. We hope you learn more about the concept of feminized labor and what can be done to make sure that costume professionals achieve pay and labor equity in theater. Before we go, I'd like to say thanks again to our incredible guests, Portia McGovern, Elsa Hiltner, and Jessa Ray Court. Links to their social media and all the resources they've mentioned here are available in our episode description and at our website, dirtylaundrythepodcast.com. Dirty Laundry is committed to compensating our guests for their time and emotional labor. To support us, please visit our website and donate. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at dirtylaundry.thepodcast or email us at dirtylaundry.thepodcast@gmail.com. Dirty Laundry Unpacking the Costume Closet is produced by Johanna Pan and Shayna O'Neill, with music by Jay Ong and audio engineering by Justin Sabee.